Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the early hours of June 1, 1921, a siren or whistle sounded in Tulsa just after 5 a.m., and the white mob and local law enforcement that then moved into the Greenwood community was armed with weapons, guns, and cameras. As a result, University of Oklahoma Regents professor Carlos Hill says that the Tulsa Race Massacre is the best documented episode of racial violence in the early part of the 20th century. Some of those images have become infamous and are familiar, yet still others are still revelatory, now nearly 100 years later. Professor Hill has assembled a new book that shows this documentation of the destruction, the loss of life, the wholesale internment of the city's black population, and the evident pride of the city's white community that, in the ironic vernacular of the time, quote, put down a Negro uprising, unquote. But the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, a photographic history, also documents the resiliency of Tulsa's Greenwood community. With the words of survivors juxtaposed throughout, you see how this community moved from survivor to refugee to rebuilder to thriver as the community came back, despite obstacles to rebuilding and no compensance for their losses. Carlos Hill is the Regents Professor at the University of Oklahoma and the chair of the Clara Luper Department of African and African American Studies. He's the author of three books, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture, and Memory, The Murder of Emmett Till, A Graphic History, and now his latest book, The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. Professor Hill, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In publishing this photographic history, you write that unlike other episodes of racial violence that occurred about the same time, they were the so-called race riots, unquote, after the end of World War I. Tulsa was one of the most photographed incidents. And you asked the question, why? And I would ask you the question, why do you suppose that was?
The race massacre, the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, was the deadliest attack on a black community in American history. And I would even maybe go as far as saying any community in American history. The Greenwood District, circa 1921, was a 35 to 40 block area that was teeming with people and businesses. We, you know, based on census records, there were, you know, over 10,000, nearly 11,000 black residents of the Greenwood District. There were nearly 200 black-owned businesses, and the majority of the land in Greenwood was owned by black people, which was a stark contrast to the daily realities of most other black people in this country. And so Greenwood, Black Wall Street, was a symbol of black excellence, and it remains a symbol of black excellence. And so the mob that attacked the Greenwood District numbered in the hundreds and perhaps even in the thousands. And so those individuals, those invaders, as survivors called them, came into the community in the hundreds, some armed with weapons. Many came also with cameras and took photographs of the destruction and the loss of life. And so when I talk about the race massacre, I try to be very clear to people that what occurred in Greenwood, or what happened on May 31st and June 1st, the destruction of this exemplary black community, not just an affluent black community, but this exemplary black community, the destruction of that community was not exceptional. This occurred. Mobs attacked black communities and had attacked black communities for decades before the race massacre. Black people were driven from communities, you know, across this country for decades before the race massacre. And so what occurred in Tulsa, what occurred and what happened to that community is not exceptional. But what is unprecedented about what occurred is its scope, right? A 35 block area, one of the wealthiest black communities in this country, in a matter of 18 hours, completely destroyed. And not only was it completely destroyed, whites who participated in that destruction documented it with photographs. Whites who took photographs of the violence were careful not to take pictures of whites who were looting Greenwood or actually lighting fire to buildings or even dropping bombs, incendiaries on the community. But what they did document was the destruction, the physical destruction of Greenwood. They documented some of the black victims of that violence. They documented the detention. They documented the ways in which, to a certain degree, Greenwood in circa 1921, 22, rebuilt itself. And so what we know from the, about the massacre photographically comes from whites. And I would say whites who entered into the community on June 1st. Some of them were armed. Some of them came armed and perhaps with cameras to document not just what occurred, but the suppression of a quote-unquote Negro rebellion. And so at the time, this was whites documenting racial violence, such as lynchings, was common. So for Tolson to go into Greenwood with cameras and begin to take pictures of what occurred was not abnormal. It was a part of lynching culture. And so when we think about the race massacre, we cannot exceptionalize it. We need to understand it as a part of American culture, right? We need to understand it as a part of lynching culture. But what makes the race massacre so important is the scope and the scale of what occurred. A community the size of Greenwood, you know, the affluence of Greenwood, a community that size was destroyed in less than 18 hours. That is unprecedented. And that's what we need to really be thinking about as we near the centennial.
In the course of the book, there are a number of pictures that have been seen over and over again. But what you see in this book is so many pictures, some very familiar, others not so familiar, that again points out that scope. Certainly there are pictures of the devastation. There are pictures that show a street level. There are also pictures from hills from different vantage points of the community. And you get the sense of the scope of the devastation. I mean, this, the only thing I can compare it to is the aftermath of a total warfare battle in what would be World War I or World War II. This community was utterly destroyed.
The community was annihilated. You know, everyone in the Greenwood District was impacted by this. If you had 10,000 plus black residents living and working in the Greenwood District, you know, at the time of the massacre, those same 10,000 plus individuals were rendered homeless on June 1. And so everyone, every black person in the community was impacted. And when you look at the photographs that whites took to document and to tell the story of the suppression of this quote unquote Negro rebellion, you know, we have to be careful to situate this. I would say that if you just look at the photographs without any context, yes, it looks like photographs of Berlin that had, you know, been bombed by the Allied forces during World War II, or perhaps even Paris. But it's an American community, and it's a black community, one of the wealthiest black communities of its time. When we think about the massacre, what I've tried to be clear about and why I talk about it as a massacre is it was a systematic military-style assault on a civilian community that was aided and abetted by local authorities and a white mob. And so this invasion of the community that began in earnest at 5 a.m. on June 1st, this invasion, there was resistance, black resistance, collective armed resistance to this invasion, because black Greenwood residents who had worked and toiled and built this magnificent community wasn't going to let it be destroyed without a fight. And so it's very important for us to say that Greenwood, Black Greenwood, was not at war with or in rebellion against white Tulsans. They were simply in defense of their community that they had in a decade's time, or let's say 15 years' time, built into one of the most affluent Black communities, period, in the country. And so, you know, I've heard people say, having looked at the photographs, this was a race war. It was not. This was a white community that had been a white mob that had been weaponized by the local authorities to attack a community, and the Black community, in their self-defense, tried to prevent it. And so this is not a war. But what we did see occurring was a community that represent the tradition of collective armed self-defense. And this is something that I'm intimately aware of because I've studied it across the lynching era, how Black communities would arm themselves to try to prevent a lynching or an act of racial violence. And so what Greenwood residents did, and certainly Black men who went downtown to try to protect Dick Rowland from a lynch mob, they were brought there not just out of concern for Dick Rowland. They came downtown because of the tradition of collective armed self-defense. Because, you know, Black people, Black Americans, and I know Black Tulsans understood that the best way to stop a lynching was not to try to moralize and write editorials after the fact, but the best way to stop a lynching was to actually stop a lynching, to put one's body between the threatened lynch victim and the mob.
My guest today is Carlos Hill. He's the Regents Professor at the University of Oklahoma. He's the chair of the Clara Luper Department of African and African American Studies, and he's the author of a new book titled The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, a Photographic History, which assembles several hundred photographs of the massacre, the immediate aftermath, the interment, the long process of rebuilding in the community. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, again, another question you ask in the introduction is the psychological perspectives of white Tulsans and what becomes clear. And again, as you mentioned, you have to see these pictures with the context, oftentimes with just the captions that were placed on some of these photographs, which were turned into postcards as a way to, I don't want to say celebrate, but at least acknowledge white superiority at the time. That psychological perspective becomes pretty clear. And you see some really amazing images that some I'd never seen before. You mentioned there were very few pictures of white people actually committing acts of violence and looting, but there are some pictures that inadvertently capture that. There's one picture that's really, it really made an impression on me. You see two armed men walking away from the fires. You see the fires in the background in the Greenwood District, while a whole another set of onlookers, which would include women and people like looking like they're going to a picnic, are heading into the Greenwood District to gawk and onlook. To me, that is a really telling photograph.
It's telling because, you know, in many ways, what I always say to people about photography of racial violence is these images are not created for us, you know, for a 21st century audience. They're created for an audience who assume and actually believe that white people are superior to Black people, that Black people are inferior. Not only are they inferior, they are a criminal class and are intellectually, you know, socially, culturally inferior. So inferior in all ways. And so the ease with which whites would take pictures of deceased Black bodies or destroy Black community wouldn't have been something for whites that was controversial. But today, of course, it is controversial, and it should have been controversial in 1921, but it wasn't because of the deep and unabiding belief in white supremacy and Black inferiority. And so you can't understand those photographs with understanding just that basic context that it was not controversial to kill Black people in public vis-a-vis lynching. It was not controversial to destroy a black community because the rationale always revolved around, black inferiority and white superiority. And so, the casualness with which whites are walking through the community, and taking pictures alongside the destruction and deceased black bodies, all fits within lynching culture and the ways in which in 1921 and well into the latter part of the 20th century, white supremacy was assumed, and for whites, it was an article of faith. And so you can't understand those photographs and the ways in which white people position themselves in that photo, in those photographs, without understanding that context, because none of the individuals that appear in those photographs are shamed. None of them are attempting to hide, their likeness. They actually want to be seen, and they want their friends, family, and relatives to see their participation in this. And so this is, a different culture. It's lynching culture, and I know lynching culture survives in many ways that we are unconscious of, or most people are unconscious of, but this is why whites position themselves in the photographs in the ways that you mentioned.
As devastating as that first section of the book is, perhaps even more upsetting is the next section of the book, which is the internment, where you really see that attitude at play. At this point, people are disarmed, and unfortunately, it brings up notions of other internments that have happened throughout history that we also can see photographs where the perpetrators are not ashamed at all. They're looking on, they're catcalling and looking on in pride as this community is interred and degraded after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I have studied, similar outbreaks of anti-black violence where black people are violent, their communities are violently attacked, and they are forced to flee. And in many cases, those communities, those families never return to the community in which they were expelled. And so with Tulsa, the community, not only did they rebuild, but the community experienced a renaissance just 20 years after the race massacre. And so it's very important for us to understand both the depth of the destruction, but also the depth of the resilience of survivors and how they rebuilt Black Wall Street, and not just rebuilt it, but it was even bigger and better. When I say bigger and better, I mean there were more Black people in Greenwood 20 years later. There were more businesses in Greenwood 20 years later. And so, you could say from, 1940 to 1960, Greenwood experiences not just a rebirth, but a renaissance. And so, think about that. So what Black survivors suffered, think about what they did, in a short period of time, rebuild. But think about that in the context of what you just laid out, the detention, where after their homes have been destroyed, after their loved ones have been killed, they are now arrested. What happens in Greenwood is not a detention. It's a mass arrest of every Black person that's still there. Man, woman, child are taken to three detention centers, as they were called, initially at the convention hall, but ultimately at the state fairgrounds or McNulty Park. But there were many Black people who had tried to flee but wasn't able to get out, but had found a way to, be given safe haven by a church or given safe haven by a white employer. And so there were just Black people scattered about, right, who were just trying to survive the violence across Tulsa. But for those who were not fortunate enough, or those who weren't able to find a safe haven or get out of the community, they were all arrested, men, women, and children, and taken to one of those three, quote-unquote, detention centers. This is where the photographs become really important for me, because they don't just document what occurred, they also carry narratives, or they attempt to carry the narrative. And so the narrative around the detention photographs that whites at the time wanted to perpetuate was that they had suppressed the Negro Rebellion, and now for the protection of Black Tulsans or Black survivors, they would be interned. But at the same time, you know, there are photographs that try to present what is occurring as protection. And then there are other photographs that on the photograph, there are captions that are left that say, captured Negroes en route to. And so therein lies sort of that those photographs were meant to tell us, right, that this wasn't a riot, but in fact, this was a coordinated, systematic, deliberate attempt to destroy a community and then arrest them. And so the photograph to me that just sort of, I think about it, I meditate about it a lot because it's so disturbing, but it's also so illustrative of what actually occurred. On page 59 of my book, there's a photograph, and the caption of that photograph, or what's scribbled on that photograph, is "Running the Negro Out of Tulsa." Mm. And it's a photograph that shows or depicts Black residents from afar looking on as Greenwood burned in the background. And so whoever created this photograph certainly had in mind not just destroying the community, but in fact expelling Black people, not just from the Greenwood District, but from Tulsa. And so when we think about the massacre, we always need to not just focus on the destruction to the community or the loss of life. We need to also keep in focus that this was an attempted community lynching. This was a attempted community expulsion. And so the viciousness of what actually occurred, we can only capture it when we think about not just what actually happened, the community rebuilt itself, but what was intended to happen. And when we understand that, we understand the true viciousness and the horror that this history actually represents.
Carlos Hill is a Regents Professor at the University of Oklahoma, where he's chair of the Claire Looper Department of African and African American Studies. He's also a member of the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. His new book is titled The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. It's published by OU Press. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
As unlikely as it seems, the closing of an obscure college in western Oklahoma in 1918 foretold Tulsa's racial violence and slaughter of African-American citizens 3 years later. A trio of Church of Christ members established the Cordell Christian College shortly before Oklahoma was admitted to the Union in 1907. At the time, the Church of Christ was one of the leading pacifist sects in the country. Several faculty members at Cordell Christian College followed that tradition. A number of students did too. When a few faculty members voiced opposition to World War I's military draft and to alternative noncombatant service in support of the war, the Ouachita County Council of Defense investigated and issued an order directing the Board of Regents to reorganize the college to unreservedly conform to all military policies and requirements of the U.S. government at war. The school initially resisted, but threats of vigilante violence and reprisal from a secret community organization ultimately caused the Board of Regents to accept the president's resignation and to disband the school. Every county in Oklahoma during World War I had councils of defense, appointed by the state's governor without any enabling legislation from Oklahoma's elected representatives. Typically, these bodies included leading bankers, newspaper editors, and attorneys. The councils promoted the sale of war bonds, the support of the military effort and American Red Cross, and allegiance to the United States of America. In practice, the county councils of defense operated as extra-legal enforcers of patriotism that took testimony of subversion and disloyalty, rendered judgments, and meted out punishments to quash dissent despite having no legal authority to do so. Those who failed to buy bonds or who opposed the war were denigrated as slackers. Slackers were the subjects of whippings, beatings, being tarred and feathered, having their businesses vandalized or boycotted, and public acts of individual humiliation and private terrorism. The councils particularly targeted recent German immigrants. Speaking that native language was prohibited in public gatherings and even in church school classes. The Oklahoma Council of Defense dictated that every person in the state sign a loyalty oath that required not only allegiance to the government, but also a pledge to report any disloyal act or utterances by others. The Tulsa County Council of Defense was the most active. Membership consisted of some of Tulsa's most prominent people: oil millionaires, industrialists, executives of the Chamber of Commerce, physicians, lawyers, and well-connected society women, among others. The Tulsa County Council held that treachery and sedition must be ferreted out and the authors deprived of all powers of wrongdoing. To accomplish this, the council paid a detective to watch for sedition and had a secret organization to observe and enforce loyalty. The Tulsa County Council of Defense also mustered up a citizens' militia. The Home Guard, as it was known, rounded up slackers, men and women caught with their prostitutes or johns, the alleged disloyal, and union organizers. When 11 members of the Industrial Workers of the World, suspected of being traitors for organizing a labor strike against the oil companies, were convicted of vagrancy, the 11, together with their 6 defense witnesses, were immediately turned over to the black-robed Knights of Liberty, who took the 17 out to the country, where they were stripped, whipped, tarred, and feathered, and ordered out of Tulsa County as the abused union members watched their clothes go up in flames. A Western Oklahoma newspaper writer declared at the time, "The law is only a crystallization of public opinion, and during this period of war, public opinion itself was the law, not the written word. In matters of patriotism, disloyalty, and sedition, the decrees of the unelected councils of defense constituted the law. Enforcing patriotism by prevailing opinion resulted in governance by vigilanteism." World War I ended on November 11, 1918, and the councils of defense soon thereafter officially disbanded. 3 years later, a group of African Americans stood to protect one of our neighbors from being lynched, a courageous but then subversive act. Tulsa's 1921 Holocaust of death and destruction ensued. Does it surprise you that members of Tulsa's former citizens' militia, the Home Guard, born to enforce patriotism and root out subversion, moved into the Greenwood District not to protect it, but to destroy it?
Mark Dara is a local attorney and a contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thank you very much for listening.